You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell.
100 years ago, Europe was stumbling toward war after the assassination of Austrian Archduke Ferdinand. World War I saw warfare on a new scale, in some cases with tens of thousands of soldiers dying in the course of a single day of battle.
The war ended in 1918, but our next guest says the impact of that war echoed through the rest of the 20th century, and it shows up even in today's headlines a century later.
David Reynolds joins us now. He's a professor of international history at Cambridge University. His new book is The Long Shadow, The Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century. David, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Rob.
So you write, looking at it on the American side of things, that World War I is the forgotten conflict of America's war-torn 20th century. Why is it largely forgotten here?
Well, the United States was only involved in it for 18 months, from April 1917 to November 1918. And it was a struggle which was eclipsed later on by the length and the magnitude of the Second World War, which is what really catapulted the United States into the realm of a superpower. But I would say that the roots of many of the attitudes and in some ways the problems that the United States has grappled with in the 20th century lie in that period around the Great War, as the British called it, the First World War, as it became. And that's why I think it casts a long shadow for America, as it does for many European countries.
Well, certainly looking at news in the headlines this week, conflict between Israel and Palestinians, a Sunni group trying to form a new country in Iraq and Syria, conflicts on the border between Russia and Ukraine. How much do these kind of problems rise from the collapse of major empires and attempts to redraw maps at the end of World War One?
Four great empires that had controlled most of Eastern and Southeastern Europe for several centuries fell apart in 1917-18. The Tsarist Empire, the Russian Empire, the German, the Habsburg Empire in the Danube and the Balkans, and the Ottoman Empire in Southeastern Europe in the Balkans and out into Asia Minor. So that, for example, Palestine is a creation of the period after the Ottoman Empire fell apart. It was a country that was taken, or an area that was taken by the British, was held as a mandate, as a trust from the League of Nations. But the British grappled with the problem of relations between Arab inhabitants and Jewish settlers, and that's a problem that takes us right through to the present day. The British also got Mesopotamia, which became the country of Iraq. At the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, the Kurds were asking for their own separate state. Kurds and Kurdistan is right in the headlines today, as is another country that tried unsuccessfully for independence in 1919, Ukraine. And Ukraine is right in our headlines and has been for several months. So these are old topics that are still hot news.
And part of the problem and part of the reason those maps were so contentious at the time and to this day was a concept of what constitutes a nation that arose with the post-war settlement. Can you talk about how the Great War, then World War One, changed the way we talk about nations?
Yes, these are various ethnic groups that, in the days of the big empires, kind of sheltered together under this large umbrella. Sometimes the treatment of the minority groups was quite tolerant. It was, for example, in the Ottoman Empire. It was, to a degree, in the Habsburg Empire. But during the wartime conflict, these ethnic groups developed a kind of either-or sense of identity, that you were either for the country or against it. The whole sense of national identity became much sharper, much more conflictual. And that's the kind of identity problem that we still had right down to the present day. Of course, the issue was compounded by the way that the Bolsheviks, Lenin in Russia, and then Woodrow Wilson, the American president, talked about self-determination, self-determination for these nations or national groups. But exactly what was the national self, how you define the nation, that became enormously important and enormously problematic in Europe in the 1920s and 1930s. And indeed, it was those kinds of questions that laid the seeds for the next war in countries like Czechoslovakia and Poland.
Well, and it seems that you mentioned Woodrow Wilson and the Bolsheviks. In some ways, they came at opposite approaches. Wilson saying nations, ethnic groups had the right to their own country, to self-determination. Ultimately, in the Soviet Union, it seemed there was an effort to forget about nationalities as much as they could, freeze them and define the nation differently. And obviously, at the end of the Cold War, the nations, the nationalities, the ethnic conflicts were still there.
Yes, that's true. Lenin and the Bolsheviks used the concept of self-determination as a kind of revolutionary tool to encourage the breakup of the big empires. But then their conception of the Soviet Union was a multinational state controlled by an overriding ideology, which, of course, was a cover for essentially Russian nationalism. It was Russia that controlled the Soviet Union. So you're right that in that sense, the question of national identity was frozen during the Soviet period. It was also frozen when the Soviet Union took control of Eastern Europe in countries like Hungary or in Poland. And then this whole debate about what constitutes a nation really opened up again after the Cold War, and we're still seeing it going on. You know, we often say, oh, the Cold War ended in 1989 or 1991, but there are ways in which the legacies of that Cold War are still with us, and as I've argued in my book, In the Long Shadow, those problems are themselves rooted in the fallout from the war in 1914-18.
We've mentioned the Bolsheviks. One obvious major change in government there from Tsarist Russia to the communist Soviet Union. You also say the outcome of World War One and that Russian Revolution changed politics in the United States and increased antipathy toward any kind of leftist politics. Can you talk about that bit of fallout?
Yes, I mean, the United States came into the war late. Woodrow Wilson was very clear in 1914 that the United States should not get involved in the conflict, that it was a European conflict pitting old world empires against each other. And Wilson was afraid that the fallout in the United States would be considerable if countries that had sympathies with one side or another or national ethnic groups that had sympathy one side or another got antagonistic towards each other. There's a lot of German Americans, a lot of Irish Americans on one side, people of British stock on another. And so Wilson wanted to keep out. Once the United States got in, Wilson and the American war effort really ratcheted up the sense of antagonism against Germany as the enemy. To persuade Americans, I think, that a war 3,000 miles away was a war that mattered to them and that they should be emotionally involved in. And I think after the war, that 100% Americanism, as it was known, carried over toward the new enemy, in this case, the sense that there was the leftist threat, the Bolshevik threat. And I think that the Red Scare of 1919, the anti-Bolshevik, anti-leftist fervor at the end of the war, which was fueled by this continuing 100% Americanism, helped to define America's sense of its own identity in enduring ways. Because what is striking about America in the 20th century compared with Europe is that the country has had no significant socialist or communist parties of the sort that were absolutely fundamental to the politics of much of Western Europe and Eastern Europe through the 20th century. And the Cold War, of course, was a reinforcement of that sense that American political values were very much to the right of center as far as the political spectrum in Europe was concerned. So I think this sort of this black and white sense of national values and national identity was something that has been fundamental to American life through the 20th century, and it has its roots in that patriotic conviction during the First World War.
coming out of Europe in particular, there was a sense during and after the war among many that this was a war to end war. Never again, you keep quoting people saying. Obviously, it happened again in fairly short order. But setting aside World War II, how were people thinking about the future of war and conflict after World War I?
Well, the war of 1914 came as enormous shock. You mentioned that we're in Europe particularly thinking about the centenary at the moment. Essentially, it's 37 days from the assassination of the heir to the Habsburg throne, the Archduke of Austria-Hungary, to the British entry into the war. In other words, and that's the last of the major powers involved. So it's just about a month or so in which a crisis comes in many ways out of the blue. You can see that there are structural problems in Europe, but nobody's expecting this sort of just complete slide into crisis, confrontation, and a war that then engulfs the whole of Europe. So so there's a huge sense of shock, I think, after the war, and a lot of trying to think out how you prevent this happening again. And the whole idea of the League of Nations is really to create some kind of forum in which the powers can talk before they fight, before they get to blows. And the search for some kind of mechanism to control international relations, to control this intense nationalism, is something that's really fundamental to the 1920s and even the 1930s. But the 1920s in particular is a period where people really put a huge amount of energy into peacemaking in the United States and in Britain. There are huge popular peace movements, huge movements for disarmament, involving, to a large extent, women who have got the vote in both the United States and in Britain as a result of the war. And their energies go into saying never again, and the way we do this is through supporting some kind of international body to resolve disputes before they escalate to conflict.
We're talking with David Reynolds of Cambridge University about his new book, The Long Shadow, The Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century. Coming up, we'll talk about changing ways people have remembered and talked about the First World War. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We continue our conversation with David Reynolds, a professor of international history at Cambridge University. His new book is The Long Shadow, The Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century.
And David, you write not just about the direct outcomes of World War I, but the changing ways that people have looked back on it and remembered it over in different times and in different places. How has that evolved as we mark the 100-year, I should say, anniversary of the war?
Well, one of the things I argue in The Long Shadow is that we see the war of 1914-18 through the lens of the war of in Europe 39 to 45, or for the United States 41 to 45. In other words, we see the First World War refracted through the Second War, and that's different in various countries. In France, for example, the Second World War is a national humiliation. The French army surrenders, collapses in a month. The French puppet government then collaborates with the Nazis. This is an issue which has darkened French politics for many decades in the later part of the 20th century, whereas the French look at the First World War as a noble sacrifice to purge the country of the German invader. For the British, it's kind of the other way round. We, rather like you, think about the Second World War as a good war, as a noble one, one that ends in a clear-cut victory, defeating a terrible evil of Nazism. But for the British, the First World War, which is the greatest losses in British history, military history, 750,000 dead, that is a war that we continue to puzzle over, and in public memory certainly is felt to be largely futile, a struggle, you know, of mud and blood in the trenches, getting nowhere, and in which the main illumination for British people comes not from historians or politicians, but from the war poets, which is, again, a very distinctive take on the war. So I think that in each of our countries, we see the war, the First War, through through the lens of the second. For the United States, I think the story is much more sequential, that the First World War was seen as a kind of mistake in the 1930s, but then during the Second World War is presented by the Roosevelt administration as the first stage towards America taking a decisive role in guiding world affairs. And when the State Department is running its campaign for the United Nations in the Second World War, it describes it as America's second chance to seize the reins of world leadership. In a sense, Wilson as the pioneer, Roosevelt as the man who builds on that, moving America into center stage. So for the United States, I think the First World War takes us into the Second World War, America's good war, as a rising trajectory into world power.
There's a similar story in The Economy that you tell there, where in the interwar years leading up to the Great Depression, I think you quote someone saying something like, Britain couldn't lead, America wouldn't lead the world economy. Does that legacy live on now in the U.S. playing a much stronger role in trying to guide the economy of the world?
Yeah, I mean, the First World War is fundamental for the shift in the world economy from a global economy in which Britain plays a central role to the United States playing that central role. The war turns the United States from a net debtor nation in international affairs into a net creditor nation. American banks, American public start to get used to loaning abroad, and particularly in Europe, in Britain and in Germany and so on. And then that new role is kind of brought to a juddering halt by the Wall Street crash in 1929, by the Depression. America's finances pull in. America looks into itself in the Depression. And it's argued by a number of historians that America's failure to take on that global leadership role in the world economy was part of what made the Great Depression so much worse. After the Second World War, of course, huge attempt by the United States to play a global economic role as well as the role of a superpower in programs like the Marshall Plan and so on, which is very deliberately intended to do for post-Second World War Europe what wasn't done consistently and substantially after World War One in the way of in American financial and economic commitment. So, yes, I think this is a critical time in America's emergence as a global economic force.
I also wanted to ask you how World War One changed the way we think about, talk about, and memorialize veterans of war. Very different stories, for example, in Britain versus Germany in the years after
Britain
the war.
Germany. Well, the Germans never come to terms with the end of the war in 1918. The German army, remember, is still fighting on foreign soil in the West. It's still in France and Belgium when the Germans ask for an armistice, for a ceasefire. And then when they ask for a ceasefire, the shock in Germany itself, where the public has been persuaded that they're just on the verge of victory, that the shock is so profound that the whole political system collapses. The Kaiser is overthrown, a republic is declared, revolution breaks out on the streets. And Germans struggle to understand what has just happened to them in 1918. And the disconnect is explained for many people by the argument that Germany had been stabbed in the back at home. The German army had been stabbed in the back at home by leftists and pacifists and so on. This is the argument that Hitler peddles with particular success, but it's done by a lot of right-wing groups. So that for those on the political right in Germany, the argument or the contention is not never again, but if you like, bring it on. We need another round. We need to get revenge for what has happened. For the British and for the French, the take is very different. This is a huge sacrifice. The war can be justified. The sacrifice can be justified if you ensure that there isn't another conflict like that again. And those attitudes feed very much into what was known as appeasement in the 1930s, the appeasement by the British and French of Nazi Germany in part because of this deep public feeling that war on that scale, again, is just unacceptable.
We've only really scratched the surface, but I think a big lesson from your book is, as much as World War I, the Great War, was an unintended war in many ways, war has huge unintended consequences mm-hmm. that no one can predict when they get into them. Do you have lessons you think we could draw from that today?
Yeah, I think so. I think that many of the statesmen who went through those 37 days in 1914, in the summer of 1914, spent the rest of their lives trying to think through what exactly had happened, because the consequences of their actions were not what they expected, and were hugely catastrophic. So that, yeah, I think that it's a sort of Pandora's box, if you like, that when you open it, when you resort to war, you don't know what the consequences will be. I would say that you can see that in the intervention in Iraq 10 years ago, a conflict that was supposed to resolve a number of things in a short surgical way and, of course, has opened up a huge long conflict for the United States, for Britain and other powers, and one that is still not resolved today. And the situation in Iraq is now extremely problematic and fragile. So that going to war is a risky thing in all sorts of ways, not just because of the loss of life, but because you just don't know what is going to happen when structures, political structures, state structures are attacked and violated and changed. The fallout can be immense.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was David Reynolds. He's professor of international history at Cambridge University. We've been talking about his new book, The Long Shadow, The Legacies of the Great War in the 20th Century.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.